Thank you for coming. The subject of this talk will be interacting topological phases of matter. And the first slide, as we expect, will be on quantum Hall effect, because this is the experiment that marked the opening of our study of topological phases of matter. And in a quantum Hall effect, what we do is we have this context measuring the conductivity in the xx and xy direction, and we get this longitudinal and Hall resistance or conductance plots. And a theorist perspective is also provided. It's like they're perpendicular current to the electric field. And besides the measurement of the Hall conductance, another important feature of the quantum Hall effect is the fractional charge on the edge, where we use a tunneling point contact so that they're tunneling between the edges, and we measure the fractional charge. So that's another important measurement for the quantum Hall phase of matter. And importantly, both of these measurements, actually almost all the primary or most prominent experimental probes to the topological phases of matter are via electromagnetic response, because essentially that's almost the only thing that we can really control in experiment. I would note that there's a recent measurement of a thermal Hall effect on the edge that is a beyond electromagnetic response. But most of the measurements are electromagnetic, as we would expect. Now, there comes an issue. That is, the electromagnetic probe is actually missing from a big theoretical framework of interacting topological phases. This sounds a little bit surprising, because if you build any theory of phases of matter, why would you not build in electromagnetic coupling? But that, in some sense, indeed is the case for this framework for interacting topological phases. So now let's explain what we mean by that this probe is missing in our theoretical framework. An important theoretical approach towards studying interacting topological phases is through the construction of exactly soluble lattice models. For instance, the famous Kitaev's toric code that we'll look more at later in the talk. The advantage provided by exactly soluble lattice model include that it provides a concrete means of computation, and well, since everything is exact and manifest, it provides explicit physical picture. And because of the universality of phases of matter, these two advantages get carried over to other more intricate models. So we can learn the more complicated models from the exactly soluble model. Moreover, since this is a lattice model, it shows the realizability of the phase in solid state systems, at least in principle. And of course, as physicists, we pursue fun and beauty in our day-to-day work, and we do get satisfied in this respect by constructing these models. But in order to enjoy any of these advantages, we first need to put up a big question mark. That's how to construct these models, right? We need to be able to construct them. And the first thing to course out is to use smartness, because the whole point of building theoretical physics is to make things systematic, so things appear sort of more and more trivialized to us, but they are actually falling into a systematic, coherent framework. So we need to do things systematically. And through all these years of development, it turns out that a large class of these interacting topological phases are systematically built from a construction known as the renormalization fixed point construction, which we'll get into later. The name is sort of expected because we are talking about phases of matter. So what does a phase mean? It just means a renormalization fixed point in some sense. So this construction has some scary, fancy names in different fields. In condensed matter, it's known as the Levin-Wendt string net condensation, and has also been independently studied by mathematicians called the Turing-Virov's modular tensor category language. And in quantum computation, it's been developed by Kitaev in his quantum double models. So let's hide these scary names for now. We just want to stay with the more plain, understandable name. I was just showing those names to show that this construction did not come from a single field in theoretical physics. It's really a confluence of many different subjects of study, and they all come to this systematic construction that we'll introduce a little bit later. And this framework, the content of this framework is based on the braiding and fusion of anions. And in this framework, there is no natural appearance of the coupling to electromagnetic background. For instance, the simplest example is the toric code. When did we hear about the electromagnetic background in toric code? Right, we didn't hear much about that. So this is an example of it. I would say there has been examples that have the electromagnetic background built in, but are not in a systematic manner. And the point, as we just said, is to do things systematically. So this is the summary of our motivation. Electromagnetic response is the primary experimental probe to interacting topological phases. On the other hand, it is missing from our systematic theoretical approach to construct the exactly soluble lattice models. So we want to resolve this problem. And in this talk, we are going to systematically build in the electromagnetic background for a billion topological phases in 2 plus 1D. Because 2 plus 1D is where most of the interesting topological phenomena comes up. So this is the puzzle and what this talk is about. So that was our invitation of our talk. And now we are going to introduce the basic idea behind the fixed point construction that we just mentioned. And we briefly explain why the electromagnetic background is missing from this construction. Okay, so we are talking about topological phases of matter. And as we said, when we say a phase, what it really means is the physics that survives under the flow of renormalization. On the other hand, when we talk about renormalization, one of the earliest way and one of the natural way to think of renormalization is to coarse-grain the space or coarse-grain the space-time, depending on how we want to emphasize about our theory. So now we're talking about phase, and we use coarse-graining procedure to think of renormalization, and we want to study the physics that survives under the coarse-graining. So that's the general idea. And more particularly, in the fixed point construction, we are going to talk about the whole idea is that there are deep infrared low energy effective theories constructed on the lattice, which is not a real lattice. The lattice comes out from coarse graining the space or space time. So after this coarse graining, we get some effective lattice, and we build a deep infrared effective theory on this this artificial lattice. And the thing is, this effective theory on this artificial lattice can be equally well viewed as a microscopic theory on a microscopic lattice. So this is the whole idea behind the fixed point construction. So to be more concrete, let's illustrate this idea in the simplest possible example, which is, again, the toric code. Okay, so we explained this idea through the toric code example. Let's review the celebrated microscopic theory of the toric code. Normally the toric code is built on a square lattice as is usually presented, but really it can be defined on any sort of discretization of the space. So as we did now, we discretize it arbitrarily. And the degree of freedom is one spin one spin on each link. So there are all these black links here. And on each of these links, there is a spin up, spin down. It's a Z2 degree of freedom on each link. And the terms, the Hamiltonian consists of two terms. The first term is the sum over all plaquettes, where for each plaquette, you take the product of sigma Z acting on the spin around that plaquette. For instance, this yellow plaquette here, we take the product of all the sigma Z's. What does this term do? This term suppresses the Z2 flux. Because the degrees of freedom on the is Z2 on each link, and when we take the product of sigma Z around the plaquette, we are essentially measuring whether the Z2 flux through the plaquette is 1 or minus 1, or 0 or pi. So this term, in the first term in the Hamiltonian, suppresses Z2 flux, or is, we say it suppresses pi flux around each plaquette. The second term is the sum over all vertices, and we take the product over the links around the vertex. And the object is sigma x instead of sigma z now. What does sigma x do? Sigma x flips the spin up to spin down and spin down to spin up. So we can view this operation on the vertex as performing a Z2 gauge transformation. So this second term in the Hamiltonian will make it favors Z2 gauge equivalent configurations. So, and moreover, these two terms commute with each other simply because the notion of flux is by definition gauge invariant. So the first term is about flux and the second term is about gauge invariance, and they commute. And because of these two conditions, we find that the ground state is actually given by the equal Schopenhauer position of all gauge equivalence configurations that have zero gauge flux. So this is the familiar solution to the toric code. And this is the microscopic theory. Now, as we said, we want to say the microscopic theory can be equally well viewed as an effective theory or vice versa. So let's see an example of when the toric code arises as an effective theory in the deep infrared limit of a more physical model. This more physical model will be a type 2 superconducting thin film coupled to a fictitious dynamical U1 gauge field. Okay, so it's sort of strange why I would emphasize fictitious here. Actually, the fictitious is unimportant. We can equally well think of this dynamical U1 gauge field as the dynamical electromagnetic field. But in this talk, we assume the electromagnetic field is a background field just because physically we can manipulate it. Therefore, to avoid the conflict of notion, we'll just say the dynamical U1 is fictitious for now. So really, we are just thinking about type 2 superconducting thin field coupled to dynamical U1 gauge. And why I use this example, this is not a typical example for the torical topological phase, but I'm using this example because it has very physical content, right? It's a very physical, very familiar system, and it's emphasized by these people. So in this type 2 superconducting thin film, we are thinking about an effective theory. And because we are thinking about deep IR, that is, we can coarse grain the system. So we have a two-dimensional thin film, and we coarse grain it sort of arbitrarily, right? We coarse grain the two-dimensional thin film into many patches in a sort of arbitrary manner. And because the system is type 2 superconductor, in the low energy, we know the characterization of type 2 superconductor is that there will be zero or pi flux, right? So that means in terms of the gauge field, between, for a type 2 superconductor, between the patches, between the boundary of the patches, there will be a gauge transition either by zero or by pi in the low energy. But that's what a type 2 superconductor does. Now we have this coarse-grained picture of the type 2 superconductor's thin film. What do we do to get the toric code? First thing is we will take the dual lattice, right? The patches form a sort of lattice, and we take the dual lattice of that. So this lattice is due to our arbitrary discretization of patches. We take the dual lattice, and this gauge transition by zero pi between patches in the dual lattice becomes the link variable. So on each link, there is this gauge field, this gauge connection on the link that can take value either zero or pi. So it's much like a Z2 spin degree of freedom on the links. So as we can see now, the degree of freedom are getting to the degrees of freedom of a toric code. Okay, so now we have this Z2 spin on each link. And moreover, we should emphasize that in a U1 gauge theory, the connection A and the electric field on each link are canonical variables of each other. So really, the A field, the gauge connection A, is much like the sigma Z in the toric code, the Z2 spin. On the other hand, the E field, the electric field on each link, is much like the sigma X in the toric code. And physically, to get the Hamiltonian, we need to look at the physical properties of the superconductor. One property is that the superconductor, although it emits pi flux, but the pi flux costs energy, because at the vortex core, it's away from the condensation, right? So the vortex core costs energy, which means the pi flux of the superconductor costs energy. That's much like the Z2 flux in the toric core costs energy. And another thing is the single charge excitation also costs BCS gap energy, because BCS Cooper pair is formed by the coupling of two electrons. And if you separate them, then if you have a single charge excitation, it costs the gap energy. On the other hand, by the Gauss's constraint, the divergence of the electric field is equal to the charge. And the divergence of the electric field generates gauge transformation simply because E and A are canonical variables. So the divergence of E is much like the product of sigma X around the vertex in the toric code. And because charge is suppressed by the BCS gap energy, so this gauge in equivalent configuration also is suppressed by the BCS gap energy. So as in the toric code, we are suppressing pi flux, and we are suppressing gauge in equivalent configurations. So the physics is entirely the same as the toric code. So we say that after some change of variables from the type 2 superconducting thin film coupled to a dynamical U1 gauge field, we get the toric code as a deep IR effective theory. So this is a manifest example of what do we mean by that a microscopic theory on a microscopic lattice can be equally well viewed as a deep infrared effective theory defined on a lattice that is comes artificially from the coarse graining. And so previously we just showed an example. Now let's understand the picture at a more general but a slightly abstract level. We care about phases matter. That's why we consider deep IR effective theory from coarse graining. But because we have already coarse grained so much, you can imagine that any carrying out the renormalization or carrying out the coarse graining any further, the theory will not change much. It will almost stay unchanged except for some simple changes. So because it's a deep IR effective theory, it has simple rules under further coarse graining of the space-time. And those rules can be written as a set of consistency conditions. And these consistency conditions leads to the solubility when we view the model as a microscopic model. For instance, the property that granted the toric code soluble is that the two terms commute with each other, that the gauge equivalence condition and the flux commute with each other. And that source of solubility actually comes from this requirement that after under further cross-graining, the theory doesn't change much. So this is why considering the coarse-grained deep IR effective theory helps us to build exactly soluble microscopic lattice models. And this is the philosophy introduced in Levin Wan's construction of the string net model. So, and then in the contents of the theory, what are the contents of the theory? So we are considering deep IR, and what is survived in the deep IR? Well, so the braiding of the anions is survived in deep IR because the braiding procedure, as you can see, is a topological procedure. You don't care about how large the distances are. So what survives is the braiding. On the other hand, we also need to consider what happens under further cross-graining of our artificial lattice. And that leads to the fusion of the anions. So the contents of the theory are the braiding and the fusion of the anions. And the simple rules ensure solubility of the construction. So that's the Levin Wan's philosophy of the string net. Okay, this is just what we said. So now we have a set of consistency conditions coming from this idea of the phase being a renormalization fixed point. What are the solutions to this consistency condition? It turns out that the solutions already existed before our study of this topological matter. Yes.
Calling those anions, I mean, the ingredients you're using to write zero are not the anions of the theory, right? They are the boundary anions.
Yes, the input is, but the output is the drain field center is.
The input, not the output.
The input really is the reminiscent of the anion on the boundary. Yes.
If you really want to give an explanation based on the anions, you should explain why the boundary enters the cross-graining process, right?
Yes, that's true. And roughly the idea is roughly also sort of presented is because when we cross-grain, we only care about what happens between the patches of things, roughly speaking. I'm not going into very technical details of the construction, but the idea is we care about what happens at matching the boundaries between the patches, and that's sort of why the boundary anions or boundary excitations are the input of the theory, but the output are still all the anions. Yeah.
The construction can literally be understood by drawing an array of little holes in your material.
Yes.
And
yes. So in these slides, I did not include that construction, but that is also a very intuitive way of illustrating how this construction comes in. Yes. So it turns out that the solutions to these consistency conditions for the fixed point already existed from a mathematical motivated study of the topological phases. And it's called Turrif-Viro's construction, and the consistency conditions are associated to this tensor category. And later people realized that the pre-existed mathematical construction, the Turrif-Viro construction, can be interpreted as the path integral Lagrangian of the string net Hamiltonian. So they are closely related, although they have been motivated from very different angles. And as we mentioned, this same construction appeared in Kitaev's topological double model aimed at building topologically protected qubits, and related the construction is also related to Diagram-Witten model, and also there are fermionic versions of it, and so on. So this whole systematic method really is a confluence of many different motivations from different fields in theoretical physics. So now, let's briefly give some brief intuition of why the background electromagnetic coupling is not built in this important framework of constructing these topological phases. There are rough, intuitive speaking, there are two reasons. The first reason is rather straightforward. We need new degrees of freedom, because once we are able to probe the system by electromagnetism, in addition to the anion braiding, there can possibly be new degrees of freedom. Those degrees of freedom are the excitations that have trivial braiding statistics, so they are not anions. But nevertheless, they carry electric charge, so they have response to our experimental probe. A very concrete example is electron excitation in fractional quantum Hall. Right? In fractional quantum Hall, the excitations are anions, but if we consider electron in fractional quantum Hall, although it's trivial under braiding, but it carries electric charge. Okay, so this is an intuitive example of the new degree of freedom. Although, strictly speaking, the fractional quantum Hall does not belong to the models we constructed here. But I'm just trying to give us a flavor of what the new degree of freedom we need is. And the second reason is relatively more subtle. The philosophy that led us to this microscopic model was the fixed point philosophy, that the deep IR theory can be equally well viewed as a microscopic lattice theory. And the fixed point leads to some consistency solubility conditions. But once you introduce the electromagnetic background, it cannot possibly be fixed point. First of all, very obviously, the electromagnetic background usually smears macroscopically. So you cannot use the fixed point idea. And more subtly, and actually very importantly, even if we consider narrowly distributed electromagnetic field, it turns out that if we imagine a microscopic lattice model, if in a microscopic lattice model, a 2 pi electromagnetic flux is by definition equal to no flux, right? So if you have a 2 pi flux through a microscopic plaquette, it's equivalent to having no flux at all. That's why the field is U1. That's what happens if we view the lattice theory as a microscopic theory. On the other hand, if we view the theory as a deep infrared limit of some physical theory, then a relatively narrowly distributed 2 pi electromagnetic flux is not invisible. It is visible because it creates certain anions. This distinction violates the philosophy that the deep infrared model can be equally well viewed as a microscopic model. Because of this sort of contrast, it cannot be equally well. You need to do something to convert the deep infrared intuition to the microscopics. So those are the intuitive physical reasons why the background electromagnetic field is not built in this fixed point philosophy or formalism. At these times, it's often we will turn to the help of the mathematicians, like see what's there in the mathematical machinery. And I'll just briefly say that symmetry group, either global or gauge ones, are incorporated in this tensor category formalism via the notion of grading, which is mostly suited for discrete symmetry groups, but not for continuous symmetry groups. But the electromagnetic U1 is the U1 group is continuous. So although one can imagine that, yes.
Why is grading not suited for continuous groups?
Because in the grading, you have this object usually carry they both carry charge and flux, right? But when it carries flux, the way that you characterize the flux that they carry is to associate these objects, which are roughly speaking the boundary anions, with the amount of flux that it carries. So each particle is associated to a group element. So it's natural to think about object with group element for discrete group. But for continuous group, because the group elements are connected to each other, it's sort of strange to think of the group element that.
If you think about the global symmetry, you need to create by flux.
Yes, that's true. But because we are turning on the background gauge field of the global symmetry, like we are turning on an electromagnetic background. So there will be electromagnetic flux in the background. And also physically, we know that like certain anions in this quantum Hall state will carry a magnetic flux when they are placed in the magnetic field. So yeah.
I think the complaint could be that a non-anomalous U1 symmetry could be implemented by giving a Z grading to the boundary anions. Mm-hmm. And of course, a fusion category can't have a Z grading.
Because it's too small.
But that's because I said the word non-anomalous. But we know that you shouldn't.
Yes. So I think it one should be able to incorporate this continuous background symmetry, at least the U1 electromagnetism, into the mathematical machinery. But so far as I'm aware of, I don't know like a discussion of that. Indeed, I haven't seen a discussion of that. So let's look forward to the details. If this can be done, let's look forward to the details being written out or developed somewhere later. Yeah, but for now, I don't think there is a machinery that includes the continuous symmetry group, including the ENM. So we just provided some physical intuition and briefly mentioned the mathematical reason that the EM background is not built in to this important theoretical framework. Given that, we need to follow our nose and use our physical intuition from the ENM response and build in the electromagnetic response to the phases ourselves. And what we did actually is to build in this ENM background for a billion topological phases in 2+1D. There are two reasons why I restrict to a billion. First of all, it's simpler. So when we start doing something, we start with the simplest cases. Also, the electromagnetic background is most naturally coupled to abelian topological phases, as one can see in Chern-Simons theory, as we will see very soon. So we'll just restrict to abelian topological phases. So first of all, we say we'll do this, but if we do this, it better has some interesting electromagnetic properties, right? If it doesn't have interesting properties, then we wouldn't bother to do this. So let's before we say what we did, let's see what interesting electromagnetic property do we expect from this abelian topological phases. Let's again come to the simple example of the toric code, which is the simplest case. Okay, and the toric code, despite the lattice version that we just introduced, it also has a continuum description in terms of the doubled Chern-Simons Lagrangian, or actually BF Lagrangian, which written in the K matrix. If you're familiar with the quantum Hall K matrix, this is the K matrix. Very simple. And this continuum description of the toric code admits electromagnetic coupling. That the A and B gauge field can carry charges P and Q. And the electromagnetic response have some non-trivial topological properties, including the fractional charges and the Hall conductivity. Both of them can be non-trivial. So indeed, the topological phase of the toric code has some non-trivial electromagnetic response properties, even though in the lattice presentation of the toric code, we usually don't introduce electromagnetism. So now let's see how to introduce these interesting topological electromagnetic properties into the toric code. Well, so as we said, the first thing we need to do is we need to introduce these new degrees of freedom that correspond to excitations that are trivial under braiding but carry electric charges. So these are the two terms of the toroidal, the Plaquette term and the vertex term. And it turns out what we do is relatively simple at this step. We just introduce an extra integer degree of freedom within the center of each Plaquette, and also introduce an extra integer degree of freedom on top of each vertex. So besides the original Z2 link variables on each link, now we also have some integer value variable in each Plaquette and each vertex. So this integer, because Z integer variables can carry U1 electromagnetic charge, right? So we assign the charge Q and P to them, where P and Q are the charges appearing in the continuum description before. So these are the degree of freedom that carry electric charge that we'll use. And the underlying mathematics of introducing these integer variables in the Plaquette and at the vertex is called the gauging of one-form Z symmetry. Sounds like a scary term, but let's provide a very simple and familiar explanation of what we are really doing. As condensed matter physicists, most of us are familiar with the Wien model, which was commonly used to study the KT transition. Right? In the Wien model, what we actually did something is to gauge the Z ordinary Z symmetry. So what did we do in the Wien model? In the Wien model, we have a real variable on each side. And when we consider the difference between the real variable across a link, we not only take the difference, but we also subtract an integer link variable. So there's a variable M on the link that take integer values. By doing this, we essentially reduce the real variable on the side to U1, because the Wien model is supposed to describe rotors, which are U1. So we introduce an integer link variable on each link. And moreover, the curl of this link variable around a Plaquette is interpreted as the vortex, right? And the vortex is integer value because M is integer. The curl is also integer. The vorticity is indeed integer valued. So this is what we did in the Wien model. We gauged a Z symmetry. Right? This is a familiar example. Now, compared to the Wien model, what do we do here? Here, we are talking about gauge fields. The gauge fields are lives on the lattice links. And on each lattice link, we have a real gauge field. But when we consider the curl of the gauge field on the Plaquette, the total flux is not just the curl, but also we need to include an integer contribution. This is the integer variable that we mentioned that we introduced at the middle of the Plaquette. It contributes to the curl. And by doing this, it reduced the real valued A into essentially U1. So the flux, the total flux is given by the curl plus something that is not a curl, but a quantized electric field. This leads to the Dirac quantization condition of the non-trivial fluxes. And moreover, the divergence of this integer variable coming out of each cube is interpreted as a monopole. And in our theory, we will suppress the fluctuation of monopole energetically. Let's say that monopole has infinite energy, so we suppress them. But by comparing this, what we do now and what people did in the Wien model, we see that everything we do is happening in one dimension higher than what happens in the Wien model, right? In the Wien model, 0, 1, 2 dimensions. Here we do things in 1, 2, and 3 dimensions. And because of this one dimension higher, this is where the name one form comes in. So what we did in the Wien model is gauging 0-form Z symmetry, and what we do here is gauging 1-form Z symmetry. So this is the mathematical thing behind why we introduced this integer variable inside a Plaquette, and similarly at the vertices. So that explains the motivation, how we systematically motivated why we introduced these degrees of freedom, in addition to the ordinary toricals. And there's a second issue we need to take care of. This is the more subtle issue, that the 2π electromagnetic flux is invisible by definition on a microscopic lattice, but it is visible because it creates anion if we think of it in the deep IR effective theory. This is the problem. Let's emphasize again that this is the problem that makes the that makes it impossible to view the deep IR effectively deep IR effective theory directly as the microscopic theory when there is electromagnetism. So we need to deal with this subtlety, and we'll skip the procedure, but this can be taken care of systematically. And after taking care of it, we arrive at our Hamiltonians. And it turns out our Hamiltonians fall into two cases. When there's no Hall conductivity, the resulting Hamiltonian, after taking care of the previous problem, is still exactly soluble because terms still commute with each other. On the other hand, when the phase has Hall conductivity, the Hamiltonians cannot be exactly soluble because terms do not commute. And this is a manifestation of a very important recent theorem proven by Kapustin and Fikoski, that when your phase of matter has a non-trivial Hall conductivity, you cannot realize it with the terms commuting, locally commuting in the Hamiltonian. So this is a manifestation of the theorem. But if that's all we get, then it seems like we have not done much, right? Because they have proven that we cannot get something really good. And if after all this formal procedure, we just get something that is not soluble, then it's sort of pointless to go through all these things. The good thing is, it turns out that through our systematic construction, we will naturally arrive at some controllably soluble Hamiltonians. What does that mean? That means, although by this theorem, the terms cannot commute, but our systematic procedure shows that the non-commutativity of the terms can be made arbitrarily small. As long as the non-commutativity is arbitrarily small, we can say our model is arbitrarily close to exactly soluble. And indeed, we can controllably solve these Hamiltonians in perturbation theory, although these are strongly interacting topological phases. So our systematic procedure gives us the best thing that does not violate the theorem, that although it's not exactly soluble, it can be arbitrarily close to exactly soluble. This will be explained in more detail in a subsequent paper. So if you care about some of the more formal mathematics, there are something interesting that we can extend the story to fermionic topological phases and see the electromagnetic field playing its role as the spin-C connection, which essentially captures the spin-charge relation in quantum Hall. And moreover, our construction from this gauging of one-form Z symmetry can be exactly mapped to the double Chern-Simons theory in the continuum via the Dillon-Baylinson cohomology of the Chern-Simons theory. So these are some interesting mathematics that we will not go into, but this shows that our construction is also mathematically natural. So in summary, what we have achieved are some Hamiltonians that are either exactly soluble or controllably soluble with electromagnetic background. And essentially, the Hamiltonians look somewhat like the ordinary toricle or generalizations of toricle, but with the electrically charged Z integer degrees of freedom at the plaquette and at the vertex. So that's what we achieve by following our nose in this all this procedure. And all the steps we did have some very natural reason. There's no like ad hoc smartness or it's all comes from some.
Can you show us the actual
for
this?
No, I did not because to present the Hamiltonian like this, we will not use the sigma z and sigma x, we'll use 0 and pi. So there is some change of variables that we need to introduce, which will make things a little bit tedious, although it's a simple change of variable, but I don't want to show all those details here. But the essential idea is that this product of sigma z captures the z2 flux, right? So now the flux is no longer a z2 flux. It's a z2 flux plus this integer flux, as we mentioned. So the total flux is the product of this z2, which gives you 0 or pi. And you add to it a multiple of 2 pi captured by the plaquette. So you suppress that. So that's like suppressing the electromagnetic flux. And so, yeah, if you're interested, I can show you the Hamiltonian afterwards.
Sorry, I got confused.
Yes.
I thought the U1 issue is background, not dynamical. What do you mean by you suppress
the integer? Oh, because in the presentation of the toric code, we can present it as a Chern-Simons, right? Oh. In the Chern-Simons, there's dynamical U1. That dynamical U1 will actually be broken to Z2, just as our like superconducting thin film story. So the flux is the dynamical U1 broken to the dynamical Z2. Yes. And the Hamiltonian is much like the torical, but with these 2 pi flux added on top of the 0 or pi flux. Yes.
So does your anion carry fractional charge?
Yes. So the anion carry fractional charge? Yes, of the electromagnetic field. Yes. And if the parameters are right, you can also get Hall conductivity. But in that case, you get some slightly more complicated terms in the Hamiltonian. They can be arbitrarily small, but doesn't commute with other things. That's the thing we just mentioned.
So
yeah.
Does your method also apply to chiral top logic order?
No, it does not, because the framework we started with is this string net or this framework, quantum double framework.
End up something with Hall conductance.
Yes, it's yes.
Close to chiral top logic order.
I would say it has some similarity. The similarity is that on the edge, once you have Hall conductance on the edge, you must have some gapless thing, long range correlation on the edge. That's also true for chiral. But for chiral, the problem is more severe. So in chiral systems, I guess we can still write down some models that we believe are realizing that chiral phase. However, it's probably, I don't see in what sense that they are close to any exactly soluble or commuting Hamiltonian. Unlike in this case, in this non-chiral but with Hall conductance case, that we can say our Hamiltonian is arbitrarily close to commuting projector Hamiltonian. But in the chiral case, I don't know in what sense. Probably one cannot say that. So there's a degree of how far is it from exactly soluble. Yes.
You said the non-quantitative is small. That's
yes.
Does it depend on the strength of the electric field or the electromagnetic background?
The non-commutativity gives you, so the commuting projector model gives you zero correlation length, right, outside of your plaquette. The correlation between any anions separated by a lattice link is exactly zero. By the arbitrarily small non-commutativity, I mean you can generate a correlation length that is arbitrarily small.
But so does this depend at all on the actual ground gauge field that you put? If you turn off the gauge field, is it still non-commutative?
Well, if you turn on gauge field, it's still non-commutative.
Turn off,
it's still non-commutative.
Okay.
Because you can imagine that, right? Because the non-commutativity is associated with the correlation length. And it's hard to imagine that the correlation length drops to exactly zero when you turn off the gauge field. Yes.
And does it go wrong if you turn on a background field which is strong in some sense?
Turning on the gauge field doesn't affect the non-commutativity very much, yes. But turning on the gauge field, if the gauge field is too large, it may kill the phase, as in any real physical system, right? So, but we turn on a gauge field that is that is sort of mild in the lattice scale, then it will realize the phase. Yes, with arbitrarily small correlation then, but never drop to zero. Yes.
So suppose that you have a state with a Hall conductance.
Yes.
But now suppose I make the gauge field dynamical, that realizes a chiral of logical order, right?
Yes. So you're saying now that I can couple to the background gauge field, why I cannot make it dynamical? First of all, after it, let's see how you say that. When you turn on the gauge field, because when it's a background, you can just fix the gauge and don't care about adding up gauge equivalence configurations. For instance, when you turn it dynamical, you need to have terms that add you need to add in terms that creates gauge equivalence for a dynamical gauge field, and
so you're saying those terms don't commute with the original stuff.
I would say yes, probably. The way I'm motivated this, once you turn that on, I don't even know how to arrive at this description. Yeah. Because there's, as I just mentioned, there's a way to get this from the doubled transignments in the continuum, and you do some math procedure and you arrive at a lattice theory from the continuum theory. But I don't know how to do that once you have an odd number of dynamical gauge fields. Yeah. So I guess manifest it on the lattice. I think it's that it will have doubling problem. Yeah, it'll have undesired things. And to get rid of the doubling problem, you need to add non-commutative terms to rescue that. But that will make it not arbitrarily close, but make it far from exactly soluble. Yes. Yes, so I think that you can phrase the problem of having doubling theorem, and to avoid doubling theorem, you need to introduce non-commutative terms. Yes. So that explained roughly how we built in the electromagnetic background. So let's come to an outlook of this. So in this talk, we introduced this electromagnetic response into the framework that constructs topological phases. And we applied it to abelian topological phases because that's where the electromagnetic bonds response most naturally come up. And we look forward to a general mathematical framework that introduces the continuous symmetry groups into this tensor category language. I sort of believe that it must be doable, but since I am not a mathematician, I don't know really how to do that. Certainly, we should look forward to that. And as physicists, the question we'll ask is, are there more other interesting topological phases that we care about the electromagnetic response and what it might hint us? And I'll give a few examples. The first, I think there must be some interesting thing coming up, is to study the electromagnetic response in the Kitaev-Honeycomb model. The Kitaev-Honeycomb model is celebrated for having chiral edge state, so it's a chiral topological phase, and it also supports SU2 non-abelian anions. It's celebrated for this, and physically, it's also kind of physically relevant because it's a bosonic cousin of the Morrie-Fuffian state, which is the physical state that is speculated to be closely related to the 5/2 quantum Hall state. And because it's a cousin of this 5/2 quantum Hall state, it's natural to think about how we study electromagnetic response in this honeycomb model. So if we can do that, we will be moving forward, moving towards an exactly soluble or controllably soluble realization of the Morrie-Fuffian state, which will be exciting. And that's something that we expect, that there must be something interesting there. And moreover, we also look into systems that we are not sure what will be there, but maybe there will be something new. So for instance, the previous abelian topological order we mentioned measures the braidings of the anions, right? And the braiding of the abelian anions can be thought of as linked rings in the space-time. The linked rings in the space-time are the braiding of anions. And in some other topological phases, they don't detect linked rings. Rather, they detect these bromine rings where none of the two rings are linked to each other, as you can see. But the three of them cannot be separated. There are topological phases that detect these bromine ring configurations in the space-time. And they are characterized by non-abelian anions arising from abelian gauge fields. So that's a rather interesting set of topological phases. And we know that the linked rings, the braiding of anions, are somewhat associated with the Hall conductivity. They are related. So now that the linked rings are related to Hall conductivity, what do the bromine rings relate to? So there might be some new electromagnetic response that we may be able to see. And another interesting arena is in some fracton model. I'm talking about this not because this is fashionable, but because there are some fracton models, such as the X-cube model, they are indeed motivated by stacking toric code together. Because just now we talked about coupling ENM to toric code. And so it would be interesting to see what, and moreover, these fracton models also admit continuum description in terms of abelian gauge fields. So these are the features that allowed us to couple our previous models to the ENM background. So it's very natural to think about whether there will be new electromagnetic response if we are able to couple some of the fracton models to the electromagnetic field. So there are many new interesting physical examples. Some of them are very physically relevant that we can look into. And I'm looking forward to that. And thank you for coming to the talk.
Can you generalize your U1 electromagnetic field to some non-abelian field?
I don't know how to do that. Because for U1 background, first of all, the group is simpler. Physically, we can follow our nose what's going on. And also, this U1 background is relatively more extensively studied, right? So we can physically follow our nose. And mathematically, U1 can be presented as R mod Z. So that is actually important for interpreting the double chain Simon theory. And so that also helped me motivate the construction. But non-abelian, I don't know how to do. So that's why we said we look forward to the mathematicians to work out if it's possible. Yes. Also, the non-abelian background is continuous non-abelian background group is less relevant physically because.
It's very relevant since you are talking about spins, right? They're talking about Kidaev's Hamilton. It's a spin system. So then for spins, it's very natural that you have SO3 spin rotation.
Well, that way.
Yeah, you are not able to turn up the background gauge field. It's hard to manipulate.
Well, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe you can somehow synthetic ones or so. Yeah, but it's unlike the electromagnetic field, which is like very physical. Yeah.
Actually, I'm curious. Yes. How do you see the 2.5 on
balance? You don't see it. So in the effective description, the 2-pi flux will create anion.
Yeah.
You need to do some procedure to make the 2-pi flux invisible. But if you slowly thread in the flux until it reaches 2-pi, it will do something. So you need to incorporate this procedure. So that's the procedure I skipped. Yes.
So you're not spreading the 2-pi flux over multiple buckets?
You can, or you can make it on the same placket. You don't have to.
I see.
Yes, yes. But that's the step that I skipped. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's also the step that made that introduced the non-commutative term when there is Hall conductance. Yeah. Yes.
More questions? If
Now let's thank Jing.
Okay, thank you.